You're listening to episode 18 of season 6 of the GNU World Order. Hi everyone, this is Klaatu and this is the GNU World Order. Hope you're ready for it, GNU World Order. I certainly am. Today we're going to talk about .desktop files and how you too can utilize them to do neat things on your GNU Linux system or your free desktop system. We'll also talk a little bit about free software, the cliches, the myths, and we're going to debunk them all. It's very exciting. Let's get started. .desktop files are something that I heard about really first from Mako, who is a Debian maintainer, a Debian package maintainer, I think, now. In a presentation, I think, at Southeast Linux Fest, she was talking about certain little security vulnerabilities on different Linuxes, and one of them was this .desktop hack, or the exploit, really. It wasn't a hack. Well, someone hacked something to exploit something, and you just take this desktop file and make it execute some really malicious code and send it to the person, and the free desktop at the time, the free desktop org entity, had it set so that if there was a .desktop file, it launches and runs the code, and that's what it does. You'll understand exactly what that means in a moment, but obviously that would have launched some kind of malicious attack if it was something with evil code in it. So I'm not talking about that because I know nothing about hacking and exploiting and things like that. But I do find the .desktop files immensely useful and quite nice. So first, naturally, because this is the GNU World Order, formerly known as the Bad Apples, I'm going to give you a little bit of history on some similar concepts in another OS that I sometimes mention, and why it's really not done very well, and then I'm going to contrast that to .desktop files, which are actually really, really neat. So in OS X, I bet you knew what OS I was talking about. Yeah, in OS X, there is a convention where they will take a folder, and they will give it a pretty icon, and the folder has a hidden extension of .app, and the .app app, the .app file is interpreted by the Finder, the GUI interface of macOS, as not a folder at all. It becomes basically an executable. It's not a binary executable. It's a .app folder. And if you go into this folder, then you'll see the contents of it. And there are things like contents and resources and resource forks, and you go into that further, and there's an info p list, and you go into that further, and finally sometimes somewhere in there you'll find an executable binary file that is actually being run when you double click on that foo.app. Of course this is Apple, so it wouldn't be called foo.app. It would be called something like idemo.app or something like that, but you get the idea. It's an application. And to the normal user looking at the thing as it is presented to them, it is an application. It is this mysterious thing that just kind of runs when they double click on it, and they really have no clue as to what it is or how it is or anything like that. Some more advanced users, they call them power users on macOS, they'll know that you can control click or right click on the .app file and then go into that folder. You can show contents or something like that and go into it and kind of dig around. Or if you're in a terminal, of course, you can actually move right into that folder just with a simple cd command, because the terminal doesn't see it as this magical entity. And I say that this is badly done for a couple of different reasons, and one of them is because it, once again, it really does obfuscate in a very, very effective way from the user what's really happening when they double-click on this thing. I mean, if your users don't even realize what is a folder on their own system contrasted to a binary executable file, just in my mind, you're obfuscating stuff a little bit too much. You're going overboard. I could, there could be differences of opinion there, but that's how I feel about it. And it just takes people, it's not that they need to know that there's a difference, but it's not letting your users understand. So they've got these .app files or folders, and you double-click on them, and they run all the different little binary things inside of them, and that's how it's done. Another thing that annoys me about this system, I have no clue how that's done. I'm not a developer. I'm not paying my $1,500 to go to the Worldwide Developer Conference at Apple. I'm not paying them my dues. I'm not paying for anything. I'm not paying Apple for really anything, actually. So I guess they don't want me to. They don't care that I do or do not know what's going on with their little .app files. But I am someone who is knowledgeable about Macs, and I'm someone who supports them. Like it or not, I get calls from everyone I know about Macintosh computers, whether it's on a regular job, on a freelance gig, from my family, you know, whatever, I'm gonna get asked about this stuff. And there have been a lot of times that I've been able to come up with interesting solutions to interesting problems. And my knowledge is with the Unix stuff, so that's what my solutions are. And I would love to be able to make little applications for these people to click on, and they could actually run and do things, and that would be great. And as it is right now, there's just no way to do that, really. I mean, there's this little thing called Automator, and you can kind of do some stuff with it, but it just, take it from me, it doesn't work the way that you think it works, it doesn't work the way that it should work, and it doesn't work. So that's that. So my point being that someone who can solve little problems for users is being held back, being prevented from actually implementing a lot of those solutions, because the ultimate answer is, well, here, move aside, I'll type in some magic into this black box with green scary letters in it, and your problem will be solved right now. And next time you have that again, just contact me again. And if I want to get around that, then I have to learn at the very least, Python. And even that, it's going to be tough, because we're not talking about Linux. .desktop files, what do you know? They are the perfect solution for people just like me, and for a lot more than that. So what is a .desktop file? Well, a .desktop file is, surprise, surprise, a plain text document. But the cool thing about these little .desktop files is that they are interpreted by a free desktop environment they look to the user at like an executable file. And I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, but Klaatu, that's exactly what a .app is on the Mac OS X, and you just got finished saying how horrible that was and how deceptive it was. Well, there's a huge difference between plain text and a folder concealing indecipherable path towards something that will ultimately run a binary file. Believe me, there's a huge difference, because the .desktop files, I sat down and, I guess you could call it, reverse engineered in about 15 seconds. And for as long as I studied it back when I was actually caring about macOS and stuff, I could never figure out the .app. Not to say that it's not understandable. Obviously, people understand it and know it. But I will say that for someone who's not a programmer and who is just kind of hacking their way through all of this stuff, the .desktop one was a lot simpler. Another advantage to the .desktop file is that, well, like I say, it is plain text, so you can open it up, you can read it, you can understand what it's doing literally in about 15 seconds. And here's one now. So the first line is desktop entry, that's in square brackets. It's two words, desktop space entry. Version 1.0, have no clue what that means. Encoding, you probably think it's the version of the application, right? It's not, it's something else. Encoding equals, well, UTF-8, right? We all love that. Name equals Emacs space 22 space paren x11, close paren. Okay, that is the name of this entry, of this desktop file, of what it represents. So if I go to my user share applications and I look in that directory, then I see an emacs.desktop file, and I know if I click on that, that's going to launch Emacs. So the name of that entity, sort of like the metadata almost of that unit, is Emacs space 22 space Parent X 11. The generic name is just Emacs. The comment that we might see in like an application menu or something like that is, in this case, GNU Emacs Text Editor 22, because it's version 22. Exec, EXEC, well, we've seen that before, right, in a .xinitrc file, for instance. Exec equals slash usr slash bin slash Emacs 22. That's pretty obvious as to what it's doing, right? So we've just basically written a pretty good .desktop file already, and it's only been like 6 or 7 lines, not even all of which are actually required. Terminal equals false, meaning we don't want to run this in the terminal, but you could make it true. You could have a script running in a terminal for that user who knows that they want to convert some files, but they don't want to actually have to see what's going on or launch a GUI application. You just want them to be able to click on this icon, have a terminal thing run, and then have some kind of notification pop up that, yes, it's finished. Type equals application. That's what it is. I don't know what our other choices are, to be honest, but the type is application. Icon equals slash usr slash share slash emacs slash 22.2 slash etsy slash images slash icon slash emacs underscore 48.png. Again, pretty obvious as to what we're doing there, I think. Categories equals application, semicolon, utility, semicolon, text editor, semicolon. And then the MIME type equals text slash plain. A beautiful, beautiful, beautiful entity, I think you'll agree. It's a very simple plain text file. You've seen one, you've seen them all. It's just that easy. Now, the really cool thing about these little text, these little plain text files, these .desktop files, is that you can look at them in Dolphin or in Nautilus, that was the word, Nautilus, or Thunar, or whatever, and they will look like an application. They will feel like an application, because when you click on it, it will launch the application that it that the icon represents. How is this different from .app? Well, I think it's really, really obvious how it's different, but it's really obvious as well how similar it is, right? It's to the end user, this is exactly the same thing, right? I show them a .app for Emacs, which, by the way, last time I checked, is 120 megabytes. And then I show them a desktop .desktop file for Emacs. To a user on any system, that's the same thing. But to us, we know exactly what's going on. We can program it to do different things. We can make it do helpful things. We can make it do malicious things. It's really, really cool. Now, the big answer to that hack, by the way, since I just mentioned it again, was that free desktop made it such that if it's a new .desktop file, it opens up and offers to show you the contents and asks you if you're sure you really want to run it. Not that that's going to get... I mean, that's probably going to get by most dumb users, but then anything's going to get by most dumb users. At least for people who are maybe looking out for those sorts of things, that's going to help a lot. So these .desktop files can be used all over the place. You can throw them on your desktop. I wouldn't personally. I don't like things on my desktop, but you could do it. And especially for those users who are used to those little shortcuts that you always see on Windows, like on the left-hand side, there's always these little, you know, shortcuts to the applications, because I guess the start menu is completely off limits for people. I don't know. Or you can you could put them down in a dock, like Cairo dock. You could put them in a panel. You can put them in the sidebar of Dolphin. You could you can put them in slash usr slash applications, rather usr share applications. You can have them appear in your applications menu. Whatever. It's a representation of something that exists on the system, and it's just one representation. It's one way to get there from here. It looks pretty because you can assign an icon to it. It's fantastic. It's the most beautiful and simplest solution I've seen on Linux since GNU. It's just, it's a beautiful, beautiful thing. And I've used it so much lately because there are a couple of boxes that I've managed to get Linux onto around here. User-facing, obviously the network's crawling with Linux, but the user-facing boxes with Linux on it, these are the answer. These are the ways that people like me who have no clue what they're doing can write simple little shell scripts, make them look like a nice pretty application, and tell the user, click on that to do such and such a task. And they can do that. That they can do. I don't care if they're from Mac OS X, from Windows, or if they've just never been in front of a computer. You tell them to double-click on an application icon, they can handle it, and it works. So really briefly, I guess, there are some other things in the .desktop file that you can include. Things like different language codes, you know, so it's generic name, square bracket, EN would be the English version, and then the ES would be Spanish, DE would be German, Deutsch, whatever. That's that. The really important parts are the fact that it's a desktop entry. I guess the version 1.0, I always put it in there because it's part of that desktop entry, I think. The type equaling an application, and then some, you need a name, you need a category. Well, I don't know that you need a category. You should have a category. You should have a generic name, and a comment is usually nice to have as well, because if it's in an application menu, then that does show up, at least in the KDE application menu. And then, of course, you need the exec line. That's the really important one. Exec equals, and then the path to whatever the command would be if you were launching it from the terminal. And then the terminal, either true or false, depending on whether this is something that's actually going to run in a terminal or if it's going to launch something else. Icon equaling the path to the icon, and then the MIME type, which would be text plain in most cases. I mean, I think like e-links or something like that would use HTML, but generally speaking, you're going to be using text plain. Okay, having gone over that little technical trick, I think it's time for a cup of coffee, so let's do it. Well, I hope your cup of coffee is as good as mine, because after a little bit of Linux, it always feels really good to have a nice, hot, strong cup of coffee. Enjoy. Okay, back from coffee then. Of course, we've all heard it, we've all seen it online, the arguments against free software. Naturally, we're not going to sit here and change anybody's mind about free software by just talking about it, right? I mean, that's not how the world works. You know, the people don't listen to a Linux Ogcast and learn about how great, actually, free software is, and then decide that they've been wrong all these years, that actually they should have been running free software after all. Well, what do you know? That's not going to happen. It's not really the goal here, but I would like to talk a little bit about some of the things that I've seen online and actually confronted people about, or not confronted, but been confronted or whatever by people about. Not that I have arguments on an everyday basis about free software. Quite the contrary, I actually don't, ever. But what I mean is when people are sitting down using Linux or something like that and are aware that they're using Linux, because again, there's a fair amount of people, by a fair amount I mean like two or three people around me who use Linux without realizing it, because I've set it up and they're just not computer people, they don't see the difference. But the people who do, you know, when they're using it, they'll say things, or they'll mutter things, you know, about free software or about this Linux stuff or whatever. And some of this is even from my own brain, because here's the thing. Nobody likes a fanboy, right? Fanboys, really, we have that term because we needed something to describe a mindless, kind of blind follower of something. That's what a fanboy is. Now, I call myself a Linux fanboy sometimes, for fun, because I do support GNU Linux. I'm very serious about supporting it. I believe in it. It really aligns with a lot of my own beliefs. at the same time, I don't want to fall into real fanboyism. I don't want to be the type of person who's just going to say, well, naturally this is better because it's GNU Linux. Because that's not always necessarily the truth. I mean, obvious example, or at least obvious to me, are we really going to, can one really say, well, KDN Live is obviously better because it's GNU Linux? My immediate reaction, actually, is to say, yes, I could say that. But the fact is that it really depends on what we're talking about, right? If someone comes to me and says, I need a really solid solution for rotoscoping, am I going to say KDN Live is your best bet if the other option is Final Cut? That would be a toss-up. Right now, I don't actually know because I don't do a whole lot of rotoscoping. But it's a very intensive kind of thing. I'd probably point them in the direction of Blender, to be honest. But the point still is that, or even Synfig, actually. Well, there you go. I guess I'm answering my own question. But anyway, I'm trying to get away from those kinds of automated responses, which I apparently do not have, because I just thought about that very clearly and lucidly out loud. But I still wanted to do a little thought exercise, and maybe, dear listener, you can do it along with me. So let's go down this dark road of anti-free softwareism in a thought exercise that I call Why I Refuse to Use Free Software. So the first point I could think of off the top of my head was actually something that I've seen on some blogs, and they haven't been Linux blogs. And one is this argument is that free software isn't really free. You know, the whole cliche, freedom isn't free. Some people have said that there's this kind of false presentation of free software. And they say that free software, first of all, isn't really free. The big applications that you hear about when you hear about the free and open source world, things like Firefox, LibreOffice, or as most people know it, OpenOffice, Drupal, WordPress, Blender to a lesser degree, just simply because it's a little bit of a niche market, MySQL, things like that. Those examples sprang from corporate code dumps, or they have big corporate sponsors behind them, or they're cashing in on some brilliant ad scheme with Google or something like that. So they're not. It's not free, right? There are people. They go to an office every day. They work on the code. It looks and smells like a corporation from the inside. And then from the outside, it's sort of like, oh, look, we're just a bunch of hippies and we're all sharing and we're all doing all this free software. So they're saying basically that there's a layer of false marketing there. So obviously, free software must not really exist, because there's really only about 5 free software titles out there: Firefox, OpenOffice, Drupal, WordPress, Blender, MySQL, so 6. And the rest of the world of quote-unquote free software is a bunch of really just a patchwork mess. And that is actually my second point that I've heard from different people. Some of these people inside of the Linux community, you know, they kind of feel that a lot of applications out there they feel like they've just been sort of cobbled together by totally different people who've never talked to each other. It's almost like you led some developers into a room blindfolded and sat one down at a workbench and had them work on it, and then sent them away, and then had the next one sit down at that workbench and continue to work on it. You know, like, it's just this patchwork, sort of Frankensteinian application. I guess that's a sense of there not being a grand vision, and I know that rings a bell, or rings true for you, because, I mean, come on, who among us has not said to ourselves about Linux, there's just no grand vision? We need some leader, we need someone to call the shots, we need someone to have the authority to say this is how it's going to be. Everyone thinks that at one point or another. Another complaint that I get sometimes, or that I've, you know, again, I don't actually get these in person usually. It's more like from a blog or from sort of reactions of stuff when I'm talking to people, and it's never aggressive. I don't get into arguments over this stuff. But a reaction that I've gotten, and something that I could even sort of feel for myself, was that free software is just never as good as it really sounds. Meaning that you go to the website of the software package, and it promises the world, it says it can do all these cool things, and you download it, you start giving it the old test run, and it just fails miserably. And you're just like, did I download the right application? Because the website made it sound so great. So, free software, not as good as it sounds. Serious concerns here. So, let's go to the fourth point. Free software has no marketing sense. Free software applications, again, I know this rings true. They have stupid names. They have stupid-looking icons. They have bad websites, or alternately, they have really, really good websites that maybe are a little bit too good. And probably bad interface design on top of everything else. So, yeah, free software, no marketing sense whatsoever. Fifth point, free software documentation is horrible. It's just impossible to make your way through documentation for these tools. That just doesn't exist, or if it does exist, it's really badly written. It was written by an automated script or something. Believe it or not, I have like six more. Free software is badly designed. This would be strictly speaking of the user interface, right? The applications just, they don't look good. The buttons are all over the place, or they're too small, or they're too large, or there's too many of them, too many toolbars, too many panels, not enough panels. It doesn't look like a nice professional application. Firefox, OpenOffice, Blender, those kinds of things, Drupal, I guess, or the WordPress dashboard, those things are excluded in this complaint. Sometimes amazingly so, like Firefox and WordPress particularly, well, and Drupal among the web people. I mean, they are sort of the pinnacle of their class, really. They're top of the class. Those, notwithstanding, the other little applications don't feel like real applications. Can't use those. Seventh point, why we wouldn't use free software if you paid us. Free software is unfocused and it will never, ever perfect anything. Free software has an what is that? AHD? Attention something something? It's got a short attention span, or programmer comes along and starts working on something that's really, really promising and very cool, and then they get a real job and they don't work on their free software anymore. Or they have proven to themselves that, yes, I can write an FTP client and now I'll just walk away from it. Or, yes, I can write an audio editing application and now that I know that I can do that, I've lost interest and I'm not going to ever touch it again. Things like that. The eighth point. The free software idea that the community will fix everything only works if someone actually fixes the problem. When it doesn't happen, there's nowhere to turn. That's the classic corporate argument, and I really think that that's probably very, very pervasive. And I felt the brunt of that myself and was rescued from it by Red Hat and the fact that they had subscription services. People like to have people to call when something breaks. And free software, more often than not, does not have that available. Don't worry, bear with me, dear listener. I know this is painful, but this is really healthy for us. This is actually proving that we're not fanboys. This is good stuff. It hurts, but it's good for you. The ninth point that I could think of was free software has a learning curve that normal computer users, normal computer users, not the geeks, just the normal people who want to use computers and get things done, they don't want to deal with that learning curve. It's just not worth it. And since we're imagining that we are them, it's not worth it for us either. The tenth point, free software just doesn't do what I want it to do. Whatever that might be, it's just it doesn't actually work for me. It doesn't accomplish the tasks. Like, if I have a checklist of things that I want to get done and I take a look at the free software solutions, it doesn't work. It doesn't do those things. The 11th and penultimate argument is free software doesn't work with the rest of the world. It's just too much trouble to try to get these file formats to match up with each other. I can't be bothered with that. I don't want to send people stuff that they can't open or that they open and it looks wrong or vice versa. It's not worth it. And then the ultimate, the final argument would be the classic, and this one I've heard from a lot of, actually, Linux developers who have turned to Mac for their new solution of ease, and it is that I paid a lot of money for the computer, I want it to just work. There's that magic phrase, just work. So that's 12 points right there that I was able to come up with as an amalgamation of what I've read in blogs, of what I've kind of picked up from other people who are saying things, and then what I could imagine in my own mind, and then what I can remember when I'm at my most frustrated, when I'm trying to get something done and it's just not working and I'm ready to blame something, anything, for my troubles. These are those kinds of things. And I think they all have a certain angle of validity to them. But here's the thing. I think that there's a crossover point. There's a point in a computer user's progression where if they've used free software for a long enough time and really become comfortable with it, there's a shift in sort of mind space, and I guess the very definition of paradigm, right? So there's this shift, and suddenly some of the complaints about this new system that they're trying to learn or that they're being forced to use or whatever the case may be, it stops being, oh, this isn't done right, because what they really mean is that this is simply done differently. And, I mean, when you're not used to it, if it's different, it's not right. It's wrong. After a little while, you start to get really, really used to it. And suddenly, the very same feature that used to be done wrong for you on this OS is the exact selling point of that OS. And I can speak about that because that's exactly how I feel about quite a number of the features on KDE, for instance. Tell you a little secret. When I first went to Linux way back in the day, I was not a KDE user at all. It was just overwhelming. It felt very Windowsy, I guess. It didn't make any sense to me. I could not grasp the concept behind it at all. Of course, this was 3. This was KDE 3.5 dot something. But you have to get there first. And it's really mind-blowing, I think, to realize that the same complaint that you have on something can then become the thing that sells you on it by the next year. That's really weird. It's almost like, are you kidding me? I mean, are humans that fickle? Well, apparently, yes. The important thing here to get from this sort of random philosophical musing is that fanboyism is related to this, because it takes us that long to kind of understand the, again, paradigm that we're working in, and fanboyism is simply the absence of getting used to that. So fanboys typically have either never used the thing which they are ridiculing, and if they have, then they've used it and they never got to that crossover point. I guess we could make allowances for the fact that some people are just never going to get to that crossover point on certain things, because, I mean, maybe some people just aren't going to like Linux. The weirder things have happened in this world. It's not for everyone, probably. I can't imagine that. I'm not too clear on how that could possibly be, but we have to assume that some people just aren't going to ever latch on to the greatness that is GNU Linux. And fanboys typically are not really those people. They're usually the ones who are simply very, very fond of the operating system that they found, and it's out of ignorance that they ridicule everything else but that one. Meaning, therefore, that I absolve myself of any fanboyism for Linux, because I only ridicule OS X, and I grew up on OS X, so it's not the experience that I lack on OS X. It is simply that OS X is a bad operating system. You may absolve yourself of your Windows ridiculing at whenever you want. Although, to be fair, I don't think me or most of the people that are listening to this show, we don't really sit around and ridicule an operating system simply for the sake of ridiculing it. So, I mean, we do for fun, but, I mean, not really. Obviously, being geeks, we're probably pretty proficient on at least two major operating systems, possibly more. So, anyway, for the record, the responses of our criticisms that we developed for our devil's advocacy. So the first point, if you'll recall, was that free software doesn't really exactly exist, that it's all a cover for a corporate conspiracy that is just making money off of advertising or corporations or whatever. And to that, of course, I mean, you can't really argue against some of that, because, I mean, in fact, that is true. There are some free software projects that accurately describes. And I think the real thing that this blogger that I took this directly from really was saying was that the only good free, quote-unquote, open-source software out there were these applications, this set of applications, and that they are the exceptions and not the rule to the open software, free software world. And that I would have to take issue with, because as I've said, I there are over 80 applications, some big, some small, that I install on any computer that I get a hold of in terms of a GNU Linux system. A whole community could not get by using nothing but GNU Linux if free software only boiled down to actually being usable to about 5, 6, 10, 16 applications. That's just so obviously not accurate that it really is ignorance, obviously, saying that that's the case. Free software being a patchwork mess. Obviously, I think probably most of us have looked at some application and said, wow, this is a patchwork mess. This was horribly put together. This should never have looked like this. This should have never gotten compiled. What were they thinking? Who knows which application you're thinking about right now? You know, we've all got probably a different one that we're thinking. I'm thinking of a funny one called FFmpegX, I think is what it was called. And that's not FFmpeg, obviously. But it was this little... Actually, I think it was freeware. It might have been shareware. I forget. But it was this little Cocoa application back in the day that actually was the way I discovered FFmpeg. I used to use FFmpeg through that long before I understood anything about there being Linux and stuff. So this application, it just looked so bad. It was the worst interface you could ever imagine. What can I say? It just was. Was that a bad application? Did that mean that I couldn't use it? Actually, quite the opposite. I used it all the time. It was something that I used for a while on an everyday basis because I was doing that much video work. So, is it a patchwork mess? It might be, but if it's well done, it doesn't really matter, does it? Now, granted, I'm not saying that attractive applications aren't important, but it's not really that big of a deal, I don't think. And honestly, I do believe that, generally speaking, that again it's starting to become the exception rather than the rule. I don't think it's always been that way. My perception is that the really, really fine work of like the GNOME HID and Celeste Lynn Paul of the KDE project, who I interviewed for, I think, Hacker Public Radio, so check that interview out at some point. I think their really hard work has paid off, and I think people are really starting to pay more attention to making sure that an application has some kind of logical flow to it. People making this argument often also underestimate the difficulty of making an application look nice. I mean the technical, not even the conceptual part, just the actual physical organization of these buttons and things like that. It's more programming essentially that you have to do in order to get the program to look a certain way. So they're missing that. But then again, they don't care. I mean, that's not the way they think about applications. They want the product to be the product. They don't want to have to think about what went into it. So still a fair argument. whether this is like a free software problem or not, I'm afraid I'm just going to have to argue that it isn't, because I've seen really, really big applications that just they're unnavigable because they're just so poorly put together. I could mention probably about a half a dozen, but I'm going to just sum it up with the word Illustrator. So it's important, I think, to get a little bit deeper, into the philosophical side of it. There's this semantic difference, I think, that I have noticed among people, and go out into the world and see if this is true for you. But when I have a friend using Linux and something goes wrong, something does not work, and heck, even I do this, to be honest. I find myself doing this, and this is a really interesting thing. Let me know if this is true for you or other people that you know. When something goes wrong on Linux, I find myself kind of shaking my head and thinking, man, that those small-time developers, man, their bad UI design, wow, what a... How typical is that? You know, that I kind of have like this... I do this seek and destroy of one individual who I can kind of blame for something going wrong or looking ugly or whatever. Contrast that, for instance, to a big monolithic corporation that's releasing an application like Photoshop or Final Cut or probably Office, although I don't use Office enough or ever, actually, to comment on it. So, but corporate entity releasing some kind of application, when something goes wrong, it's a different reaction. We have like this kind of We don't picture a person in our head, and we don't point our finger at them and say, "You don't know how to design UI, do you?" We point at this big corporation and we say, "Well, now why did you do it that way?" And it's not even indignation usually. It's more just like, "I know you know how to do this, so you must have done it right, but I don't agree with you." But we're not really questioning the corporation. We don't feel like I know better than you how this should have been. We kind of pander to the corporation. We default to it, to its choices, and we say, "Well, you made this choice, and I don't agree, but it's cool. I'll keep using your application. Don't worry about it." Whereas when it's a small-time application by a small-time developer, we seem to have this different reaction of, "I'm going to email this person right now and tell them that their button over on the right-hand corner should be on the left, and I know that. I know that right now." And I guess part of that is because free software has ability to do that, right? You can do that. You can actually email someone and say, "There is a bug or something that is enough like a bug for me to say that it should have a, that it should work differently, and I know that I can file that complaint. I know that I can email you or file a bug in your tracker." Whereas obviously corporations don't provide that. Why don't they provide that? Well, because corporations are never wrong. That's what they assert. They're never wrong. You don't ever need to file a bug with them. You don't ever need to give them an idea about how something should be done, because they're the corporation. That's a really interesting thing, that the sort of an inequality, I think, that hurts us in the long run, because there's this perception of professionalism existing with only a big corporation with a big fancy logo and faceless, mindless programmer drones, as opposed to that guy down the block who wrote a really cool application, except that the buttons on it really are ugly and he didn't know how to do the toolbar very well. Personally, having, you know, since using free software and getting involved in the community, I find that the guy down the street is a lot more exciting to know about than these big logos that I see flashing around on computers. They do nothing for me. The third complaint, wow, we're only on the third complaint, I better speed up here. Third complaint is that free software is just never as good as it sounds. Well, that is a problem, of course, and that's a problem for non-free and free software alike, for different reasons. Non-free software, it pays to tell people, to deceive people, tell them that the software is going to do something that they want. You want your users to believe that. You want them to think that it's going to solve all of their problems. And the more that you tell them that, then the more that they'll invest in your application. And the more they invest in your application, the more tied to that application they become, and the further sales you make further down the line. So it's an upgrade path, basically. Guaranteed upgrade path. It's vendor lock-in. Free software, they don't really need to do that. They don't actually care if you stick with their software or not. It's not part of their agenda. But we still do see it happening, right? We go to a website. It's glittery. It's got lots of shiny things. Someone knew Ruby. They put together a really nice website. It says that it can do all kinds of cool stuff. We download it. It doesn't do all the cool stuff that we had expected. It probably does exactly what it claims on the website. It might not do it reliably, or it might not do it to the degree that you think it should do it. I don't believe that that's unique to free software. You know, I mean, like I say, the corporate world is going to do that as well. They're very much about that. The free programmer is simply inspired by excitement for their program to I guess, what we might consider being misleading after we have tried it out. It's not misleading, it's just not exactly maybe 100% accurate. And then strangely, you have other projects that are overly conservative. They claim to do one or two things in sort of a way and kind of be ready, and you use it and it turns out that it's just absolutely phenomenal. Qtractor comes immediately to mind when I'm thinking of that. So does Kdenlive. Live. Heck, they both claim, well, Qtractor claims to be alpha, Kdenlive claims to be a 0.8 release, and it's just not true. Neither of those things are true. So, actually, from that extend two thoughts. One being, I really do wish that there was some kind of badge of readiness that a project could give itself. You know, some kind of gold label on their website that says, yes, we have confidence in this software application now. You may use it with confidence. Of course, I think in real life it was intended, I think, for that to be the 1.0 release. But in real life, any programmer, just like any artist, they're never going to look at their product, their baby, their the thing that they're making. They're never going to look at that thing and say, okay, it's done. I don't need to ever touch it again. It's never done. That's why they're programmers. That's why they're artists. It's never done. There's always more to do. There's always improvements to make. So that's, I guess, what product managers are for in big companies. You know, they're the ones who look at something and say, okay, that is ready. We're going to put a number on that. We're going to put our stamp on it and put it on a shelf, and then people can buy it. And the programmer might throw a fit and say, you can't do that. There's this bug. And the product manager says, well, they will live with that bug until the next release or the next patch. I think also, interestingly, in real life, it's partly the user's fault as well, and I know I've been guilty of this before. When a user is ready to jump from a proprietary application to a free application, there's this expectation that the free application, for some reason, and I don't know what this expectation, where this comes from. It might literally be from the browser wars, I don't know. But there's this expectation that the free version is going to be exactly like the proprietary version. And so you go to a website and it's pretty, or maybe it's ugly, who knows, but it's listing all the things that it does, and you pick up on the key things that it does. For instance, this application will retouch your photographs. It will allow you to do layered compositing of still images. It will allow you to create alpha channels, you know, all these different things. And you think in your mind, because you're out shopping for a Photoshop replacement, you think, oh my gosh, that sounds exactly like Photoshop. This will be exactly like Photoshop. So you download it. Turns out it's the GIMP. It's not exactly like Photoshop. And it's okay that it's not exactly like Photoshop. But because you, the user, had that expectation of, sounds like Photoshop to me, therefore it must be the exact same thing. Well, it's not. And that's not fair that we, as the user, dump that into the programmer's lap. Because they never said they're going to do a Photoshop clone. They said that they're going to do a graphics, an image manipulation program. So that is something to keep in mind. The next point, I believe, was that documentation was horrible. And this is one of those funny things that I mean, first of all, it's true. Documentation is horrible. It's always horrible. It's just like applications. It's never ready, right? I mean, documentation can never be clear enough. It can never be complete enough. It can never be brief enough, and it can never be complete. It will never be finished. And conversely, it's always too long or it's always too short. You know, it's this thing. I mean, documentation is never perfect. So anytime anyone says, "Well, the documentation isn't very good," it's always going to be true. Always, almost. I mean, there are a couple of instances where that's not correct, but generally speaking, that's true, because there's always room for improvement. That aside, I think that free software has some of the best documentation out there, between the stuff that you get online and the stuff that comes bundled with the software sometimes, in some cases, and then the stuff that you can buy off the shelf, like the O'Reilly books and the Pact Publishing and stuff like that. We have great documentation. There are wikis, there are documentation projects. There's a lot of great documentation out there. Now, it's a struggle to find it sometimes, because you do have to look for it, but it is there, and so I don't believe that that argument is valid, and I believe that when I hear that, I typically think that it's one of those cases where the person just needs to complain about the fact that they don't know how to do something yet. And so they say, well, if there was better documentation, I would love just once to be in a room where someone says that and to just accidentally happen to have a big 900-page document on that very application that they're using, and just give that to them and see them say, well, that's not really the problem. The problem is that I just couldn't find the save button. The next one, I believe, was free software having no marketing sense. Again, this is true in some cases, not true in other cases. Free software doesn't have a great marketing sense. I agree with that. They have silly names. They have bad icons. They do things like that because, of course, they don't have the big multi-million dollar marketing company there to help them with all that stuff. The more I use Linux and the less I care about proprietary world in general, the more I actually happen to think that in the larger scheme of things, this is either grandiosely unimportant or absolutely brilliant. Unimportant because, hey, if the application works, it works. Who cares what it's called or what the icon looks like? You can always make a new icon for it and yourself, and you can give it a new name in your menu. It doesn't matter. Brilliant because, personally, I actually get a little bit tired of the flashy, glossy, high production value, expensive marketing icons and names. I don't need to hear the word pro in every application that I use. I don't need to know that it's a product from this company. It just doesn't matter to me. So I'm kind of growing accustomed to the bad marketing sense, and I'm kind of liking it. It's a little bit subversive if you think about it. We have ugly names. We have ugly icons. We use foreign words. We use strange anachronisms that are even recursive. No one understands this stuff. It is quite refreshing, actually. It's kind of like saying you're not going to appropriate us because we're too ugly for you, and you don't like ugly things, so leave us alone. I can get into that, really. I've gotten into that. I think I've hit on almost everything at this point. I guess related to the documentation issue is the learning curve that people perceive. A lot of people think, oh, these things are too hard to learn, or they're not written for normal computer users. And I think that's just a big bias, because, like it or not, most of us were trained on non-free proprietary software in school or on jobs, and that's just how it is. I don't know exactly how that ever came to be the case. I don't know how it started going that way, but that's how it happened for most of us, I think. So, yes, there's a learning curve, because you're not using the same thing that you learned in school or at work on that one job or whatever. But in terms of whether that's a free software issue or not, it's really not at all, right? It's just a new application issue. Some people don't like to learn new applications. I'm not one of those people. I typically really, really enjoy learning a new application. I actually like that process. I like to sit down with a big manual and read it all the way through, cover to cover. And then I like to sit down at the software, and I like to just start poking around and fooling around with all the different buttons and menus and trying it out, seeing what can happen. I really, really enjoy that process. I have always enjoyed that process. Even back in the day when I was using proprietary stuff. I've read many books on software applications, and I enjoy it. It's something that I consider fun. A lot of people would rather die. They just do not want to have to do that. So, yes, there's a learning curve, and no, that's got nothing to do with free versus non-free. So that's just a, do I want to learn something new? And of course, the situation is going to influence that greatly, because if someone is getting a job and it's required of them to learn this certain software, then suddenly their complaints kind of evaporate. So it's, yeah, that's just a person thing. It's not really a software thing. The idea that the community support doesn't exactly work. Here's the thing about community support. The funny thing about community support is that whenever it comes up, there's always this notion that, well, that's not going to be good enough. When in reality, community support absolutely is good enough, because you can always throw money at the community and get results. I don't know why or how or when in the history of computing everything became so product-centered, meaning that everyone wants to go out and buy a box with a logo on it and take it home, and they want to really make it work for them. And unfortunately, because it is very rigid and inflexible and something that they cannot change, making it work for them is a really difficult process, and a lot of times just doesn't ever work for them. So they kind of use it in such a way that they can more or less tolerate it, and more or less it works for them. Why is that how it is? Why not have a community-based computing environment where when you need something done, you hire a consultant? And you have them come in and configure all this software. You find the different solutions that you need. Put them together for you. Make it work exactly how you need it to work. Extend that to even something as detailed as programming. You know, you need something written into an application. You need a feature. Pay someone to do it. It's open code. You own the code, in a sense. You can change it that way. You can make it your own. And I am really kind of curious as to how it became such a product-centered environment when we have so much control, in theory, over computers. We can program them to do exactly what we want. And yet here we are, locked into this mass production, you have to use what's on the shelf kind of mentality. And it's really, really strange. And it's almost so strange that I don't understand how people can not understand it. And I'm in that situation myself right now. I've got a network more or less at my disposal, and I keep looking at these solutions that we could drop in and pay some consultant to come, or a programmer to come in and modify it to fit exactly our needs, and we would have dropped, I don't know, 10 grand, 25 grand at once, and then we would have a solution for the rest of the life of the organization, versus 5 grand here, 5 grand there, 5 grand here, 5 grand there for the next, you know, forever. And people just don't understand the concept. And I don't know if it's just pure and simple financial mystery. Just like, what do you mean we have to spend $25, $2,500 right now when we can spend five right now, and then five later, and then five later, and then five for the rest of the life of the organization? I personally don't see how you can miss that logic, but there you go. The people do, I think. Another argument that I've heard, of course, is that free software just doesn't work for the person. It just doesn't do what they want to do. I think that's a valid argument, because people are people. They're different. We each have different needs. We have different things that we want. Some computer users don't even want to think about computers half as much, not even half, even a fraction of the amount of thought that we put into computers. So certainly not as long as this very episode. They just don't want to do that. And if you hand them something and they can do exactly what they want at that moment, then that works for them, and that's their solution. And the issue of freedom, the issue of owning the data or owning the code. It's just not even that important to them. So sometimes that's going to be true. And obviously the reverse is, as always, true. The non-free stuff just happens, you know, not to do what I personally need it to do. So I don't use it. Free software not working with the rest of the world, of course, that's an old and tired argument, and the classic response and very true response would be that it's not that free software doesn't work with the world, it's that the world isn't, the part of the world isn't working with free software, because it's all open code. They can hook into it at any moment. They simply choose not to. And I could list 30 different video codecs as an example. I could list printers, I could list file systems. I mean, to this day, the fact that a Macintosh cannot mount EXT, at least give me EXT2, just cannot do it. It's mind-boggling. So, it's very strange, and yet it is a true argument. It is a factual thing that it is difficult to deliver a solution when the bad guys just aren't playing nice. Opposite side of the coin, DocX. To this day, I have sold more people on LibreOffice for its ability to open .docx files from the new Word stuff than I have any other application, probably. It's pretty amazing. People are loving LibreOffice because it opens all these new formats that Microsoft has come out with and sort of forced on people that everyone hates. But since people are people and they don't know how to change the default file format, people keep sending everyone .docx files, and no one seems to like them. Everyone has a problem with them. But there you go. LibreOffice is kind of fixing that for everyone, so that's pretty cool. And then the one from the Linux developer or two that I've met who, you know, they used to develop for Linux and now they're doing something else for some proprietary company. And so the proprietary company, because they're hip and edgy, offered to get them a Mac, and so they got the Mac. And then from then on, they're all about Mac because they just want their computer to just work. And this is usually said snidely and through the corner of their mouth and very, very happy and very proud of themselves. It's also usually said in, I think, two different occasions, which would be one, that developer has found that they were spending too much time loving their computer, meaning that they are developing code or whatever they do all day, and then they go home and they mess around with config files, and then they jump on a mailing list and start doing some stuff there, you know, and it's becoming like a problem. It's becoming an addiction that they cannot live with. So I think some people kind of almost they retreat to Mac OS X. I got from a couple of people because they were becoming too wrapped up in their ability to just keep getting deeper and deeper and deeper into Linux and Unix and stuff. And I mean, come on. I mean, again, didn't that kind of ring true? I mean, yeah, I know I spend a lot of time on this stuff, but I really like it, and it works for me, so that's great. The other time I think they say this a lot is when they're still within that sort of 3-month period of, look how shiny and nice the Mac is, it does everything I want it to do. And it takes them about 3 months, I think. Sometimes it's a lot less, but 3, maybe to 6 months, they can handle it, you know. It's got that freshness. It's discovering new things because they had never used a Mac, and now they're learning new stuff. So it's like learning a new application, which again, some people like. And then it starts to wear off as they start to learn that there's all these different roadblocks to seemingly simple things that they wanted to do. And it's one of those things where it's almost like you didn't even think to check about that. You know, gee, what do you mean Xcode doesn't provide me with an actual programming environment except for these few things? What do you mean X11 isn't actually integrated into the system? Stuff like that. Stuff that they didn't really realize was going to be an issue. And then you usually get the inevitable blog post at that point where They're furious. They have no idea. If someone had just told them that, they would have never gotten the Mac, and they're installing Linux on it post-haste. The crux, though, is what we're defining as just working, because as I've already detailed in the previous episode when I was talking about the different things that I have to do on macOS 10 to bring it up to a level of me being able to use it comfortably versus what I have to do on KDE in order to be comfortable with it, the concept of quote-unquote just work, they're really different things. So yeah, if just working means a certain set of things to someone, then maybe Mac OS X or Windows, whatever, maybe that does work for them. Maybe that is the solution for them. I mean, I don't think it's worth it personally, but maybe that's their easiest solution. And again, the fallback argument or pro versus con of free software is that you can always find the distribution that will just work for you, you know. Depending on what I want to do with a given computer, there are different solutions to the concept of, okay, this is just going to work for me. And that's it. That's my anti-free software rant. I'm afraid I didn't do a terribly good job of being anti-free software there at the end, but I think we got off to a good start. I like to think of these things sometimes just to be aware of them, to recognize them, to kind of observe how people deal with really what boils down to frustration of not having the right solution for whatever they're trying to do, or not having the knowledge of how to do something very cool that they really want to get done but just don't. And the more I think about it, the more I really kind of think that the ultimate solution is personalizing computing. And I don't mean making people have personal computers. I mean personalizing the process of computing. And I don't know how that would manifest itself. I kind of see it as a whole host of consultants being able to go into places or come to you, and you can attach whatever price you want to. I mean, it's, you know, you can have it be whatever amount that you want. The point being that you've got people who can tell you how to do things, who can show you how to do things, who have knowledge about something that can help you assemble something for yourself or support you when you're trying to do something. And why not pay someone to do that rather than go out to the shelf and pay for a software application that you don't control? You're paying for now, you're going to have to pay for again later. You're going to have to keep paying for if you ever want your data to maintain its integrity and open ability, and it probably doesn't actually do what you think it does anyway, because it's a software application, and that's what they're all about. They do the set of things that they can do, and if you are trying to do something else in a different way, it's just not going to happen unless you can change it or modify it or configure it for yourself to make it what you want it. I think that could be a really powerful model, I think, and it would obviously mean a lot more geeks being more involved in the computing process. And other than that, that's it. That's the show today. So thanks for listening. This has been the GNU World Order, episode 18 of season 6. I'm Klaatu. You can email me at klaatu@member.fsf.org. You can talk to me on Jabber if I'm in front of the computer or nearby. notklaatu@jabber.org. IRC, I am notklaatu in the free node network. Find me usually in Ogcast Planet and a couple of other places. And you can go to the website, of course, to www.ogcastplanet.org/GNU World Order. Thank you so much for listening. Talk to you next time.
Lots in the sunshine in the garden.